So some final thoughts. All of you. We cannot get to the solve the problem we're dealing with unless we at least find comparables. We're going to have major technological breakthroughs. We're talking about getting millions of farmers using billions of hectares of land to change the way they're farming. It's not going to come all through kind of education. There are going to have to be huge technological changes, breakthroughs, hopefully. But at the same time, it's R&D, it's research and development. The world is littered throughout the economy with great research ideas that never got turned into reality because there are technological barriers to making those happen that then have to be solved. For example, if we know that we can use tree crops to improve nitrogen uptake and productivity in a lot of developing lands. But we don't use them that much, in part because it inhibits harvesting capability. So unless we figure out a way to harvest efficiently by having a bunch of trees in your field, you're not going to have tree crops. That's a development challenge that has to be researched in general. Second message is I endorse, I think, the outline in this conference, which is that research should be coordinated by teams looking at different kinds of problems. Because we're not interested in research for research's sake, we're interested in research for planet's sake. And we have to have a very strategic idea of what might or might not succeed. So whether it's rice and methane emissions, or dealing with livestock productivity improvements in much of the developing world, we need to have research that is coordinated and strategic by teams across those sectors. But at the same time, there is a tendency by researchers to become overly enthusiastic about the solutions in their own area. Because they want solutions to be there. And we have to be very wary of believing things because we want them to be true. So I think it would be also important to have outside scrutiny of the work of the teams coordinating each other. Third point, I've used a lot of numbers in this presentation, and they're, I think, the best numbers we've got. Don't trust those numbers. They are all generated in the second best way. There are wide error bars on almost all of these numbers. Now, if we didn't actually care about the planet, we could ignore it and take credit for reductions where we think we're going to handle it. But the reality is, we don't know a lot about those numbers. And there are practices that we're going to think they're going to reduce emissions, and they might not actually reduce emissions. So we need to be continuously improving and scrutinizing the numbers we're using to assess both what are the emissions and how they're being reduced. I talk about this mix of different kinds of research. The fact that we give rangeland a respective reserves. And the last thing I'll do is that highlight the importance of what you're doing. Is to say that it can't come too early, and there are some things going on right now in the policy world that I think could benefit from the coordinated effort of the people in this room. So, one of the things that came out of Copenhagen was a promise by the developed world to provide $100 billion per year in various forms of aid to the developing world to deal with climate mitigation and adaptation. And some money is supposed to come through forest protection, through bread, some through adaptation, some through mitigation. Now, one of the oddities of the bread discussions has been the belief that we can solve deforestation just by paying people not to cut down forests. Well, we cut down forests for a reason. We need the food. Bread is not going to work unless we can boost food production on the existing agricultural landscape. So one opportunity, since all rules of bread are still open, is that the financial rewards for forest protection would be coupled with financial rewards to enhance agricultural productivity in those same countries. And they're connected because if they don't, if the country protects its forests, if it doesn't improve its own productivity, you're going to have deforestation somewhere else. A second opportunity is my favorite acronym, which is ANAMA. I'm enamored with this. Naturally appropriate mitigation activities. Now, as I understand it, the way mitigation funds are supposed to work as we go forward is that developing countries will come up with their naturally appropriate mitigation activities. Developed countries will probably individually, maybe somewhat bilaterally, will review them and decide to provide funding for what they believe in. Now, this reminds me a little bit of the Clean Development Mechanism. And when the Clean Development Mechanism was formed, and there were proposals, you had real human beings with limited amounts of time reviewing those proposals. And the easiest thing to fund was the stuff that was simplest. So I don't think it's going to be hard to pick a mammoth that says, we're going to build a wind farm and instead of building a coal plant, because we can count those emissions. But what about everything you're here to do, which is improving agricultural productivity and production while reducing emissions from agriculture? There's no guidebook for what counts. If you are a Tanzanian official putting together your NAMA plan to get funding, you have no guidance for what would be an agricultural activity that the developed world would have confidence in and would fund. And if you are a USAID official deciding what to fund, and you're a busy guy or gal, there is no technical guidance as to what you should believe. And if we don't develop agricultural analysis with scientific and technical integrity, then agriculture will lose the opportunity to benefit from that $100 million. Both to increase food production and reduce human transmission. So one of the things that I think is new, unfortunately there are only so many people who know about these issues in the world. And they're going to be associated with your effort. And those same people need to get together, there needs to be an effort to get together to provide guidance on what we know today can boost production and decrease greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, as well as researching what we'll need to learn in the future. So, last summer, don't feel any pressure. The fate of the world may depend on what you do in the next 3 days, but don't feel any pressure. I think that what New Zealand is doing, bringing you all together, is a new beginning and a new hope. And the reason, despite all the pessimistic numbers, I ultimately feel optimistic is precisely because there's been so little effort to deal with these problems in the past. Now, I don't know how hard it will be to develop vaccines for livestock to reduce their methane emissions. But I do know that we just started looking at it. And I don't know how hard it would be to develop super granules that reduce nitrous oxide emissions, maybe with a nitrification inhibitor to keep the nitrogen in the form of ammonium so it doesn't form nitrous oxide. But I know that there are only about a dozen people in the world trying. That leads me to believe that while this is as important as rocket scientists, as rocket science, and we need people as smart as rocket scientists, we can solve it just like we build rockets. I wish your good luck and help in making agricultural greenhouse gas emissions the equivalent of rocket science. So in the future, 30 years from now, you say you don't have to be an agricultural greenhouse gas scientist to understand this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jim. I think that was a very interesting, thought-provoking, stimulating discussion on which to start the conference. Now, we're going to schedule approximately 20 minutes for questions or comments. on either of those first two presentations. So, any questions? So, what is your thought on that? Whenever we are talking of changing fertilizers and other inputs, agriculture inputs, to increase the crop yield and to reduce gas emissions, then again, whether the developed world is willing to share with the developing countries not only their experiences, but also the cost it goes in. Thank you.
I think cost is part of the technological challenge. So there hopefully will be some pure win-wins. As I said, that example of these urea supergranules are already 500,000 hectares, as I understand it, of Bangladesh have adopted this, and their government is really bought in, it's not going to support that or just start them more broadly. Why? It saves farmers money. They save about a third of the nitrogen costs and they improve their yields. So in an ideal situation, we're going to have technological improvements that will pay for themselves and farmers will want to do. But I agree with you, we can't rely entirely on that. We're going to need to have ways of delivering economic assistance that will hopefully motivate additional activities even beyond those that farmers necessarily have to take on their own. And I think that's a challenge. I think it comes in two categories. One is the transitions, the testing of things that hopefully then are sustainable after those. Those are easier for governments to fund. And then over the long run, for increased financing, here's a thought, for example. A number of governments fund a subsidized fertilizer. And one possibility is that instead of subsidizing fertilizer, you would subsidize a form of fertilizer. And that way promote things that increase productivity, but in ways that also reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. So I don't have any of the answers, but clearly one of the challenges has been delivering aid effectively to farmers, but there's certain effective examples. We know that cooperative standards that work, you know, the formal research works. We see what's going on in the lobby right now, we know that works. So we have good history to work with.
Further questions or comments? Yes, another question is, you didn't mention the impact that genetically modified organisms could have on productivity, and especially on those lands which today are not used. So most of the agricultural frontier could be expanded in those countries and those regions that today are not producing food in many cases.
Okay, maybe there are two questions. One is the role of genetic modification. I think it has real potential. People I respect debate how much potential. My general feeling about genetic engineering, I see a lot in Europe, and I always get asked about my attitude towards genetic engineering. And I wish people would just stop talking about it as much, because while it's an important issue, it is nowhere near as important as modeling. With or without genetic engineering, it is, I think, a useful tool for helping to boost productivity, adapt, in some cases, reduce emissions, but it's only one of many tools. But the second question I think you may have asked has to do with, well, what happens when we boost productivity and yields in a country that, let's say, has an emerging agricultural sector? While that, on a global basis, reduces our demand for land, it may promote the economics of additional land conversion locally. That's why I think that marrying bread with agricultural productivity improvements is important. Take the Congo area of Africa. Congo area, you know, when I was in college, the one thing we all knew, ha ha ha, was the tropical forest and lousy crop. And then I grew up in Brazil to prove that was important. Now, the reason we don't have tropical forests in Africa being converted to cropland is for all kinds of reasons, political history of the Congo and other things like that. But eventually, hopefully, those political problems will be solved, and there are opportunities for tremendous agricultural productivity improvement, but we don't want that to lead to the conversion problems in the Congo the way we've already got conversion problems in the Amazon. And so that's why I think marrying water protection strategies and agricultural productivity improvement is absolutely critical. And an opportunity that really doesn't exist because red, all the rules are red being developed right now.
Yes, Bob Gabici in the U.S. I really have enjoyed the presentation and really visualized and things from it. The last slide in particular, the topic you're just talking about, is one that I think will come back in our discussions of research. And I'd like you, if you would, to address some things that Peter Sanchez and other Sachs and others have talked about Africa's challenges. With the opportunity of being a net exporter in agriculture in 25 years. If land is managed right, and if you have this marriage, right marriage between grasslands, are managing deforestation while making grasslands more productive. What's the current projection of that opportunity? Because there's that 120 million hectares that the world that video suggests would do it. Are you optimistic with the right kind of science and science and technology and development? Your emphasis on D can't be addressed by the stress.
Well, I think the real number we're going to sub Saharan Africa, I think to become a net exporter would be very forward, very big net exporter. And we think that climate change is going to have its harshest impact, of course, on sub Saharan Africa. So I could settle for less of a big net exporter. I think that what we know is that a lot of productivity in Africa, I mean, again, this is terrific. So I'm speaking Pedro Sanchez to you, Sunset, a little bit modified because I'm not as emotional about it. We know that there are a lot of the soils in Africa are degraded by lack of nutrients. That's relatively easy to solve. Other soils in Africa are more physically degraded, carbon degraded. That's a lot harder to solve. And the Gates Foundation is funding a kind of mapping exercise to be able to explore that. So I think we have enormous opportunities to improve. The yield gaps in Africa are even bigger, therefore the potential improvements are even bigger than the anticipated negative effects from climate change. So we do have real opportunities, I think, for productivity enhancement. But I think Africa is one of these questions where the land use is really where we need to study. You see this map of the world where all the agricultural land is supposed to be, and basically the savannas of Africa. And those savannas are doing something today. And if people just assume they're not doing anything, I think we really need to have a much better feel for what's going on.
Thank you for your last presentation. One of your key messages is to increase productivity on rangelands in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So basically, you're right that when you have a storage, a unit of food produced, the methane goes up, but per annum, it's increasing actually. And the whole system only works when there is enough more animal products eaten. But as soon as you have more, a higher productivity, you have more people consuming animal products and then results. What do you think?
Okay, well, here's our challenge. In the energy sector, we're perfectly happy to if we environmentalists are perfectly happy to increase prices and decrease demand for energy because there are lots of substitutes. In the food area, price increases are really a problem, is a real lack of discretion from humanitarian standpoint. Why? Because the people who are wasteful for food are very inelastic for food. Because the price of crops is such a small part of the final food price. So 2008, tripling, quadrupling of crop prices, I don't know if a single person in the United States did anything different. So, unfortunately, we don't have the luxury, if we care about solving hunger, of not trying to boost production. And that even in the livestock sector, because the people in the world need more protein than the poor and the hungry. And so, unfortunately, as we make food more abundant and cheaper, that will not curb the excess appetite for protein and other products in the developed world. So I do think that we have to define our progress by emissions per unit of food. Now, right there, by the way, nobody knows what a unit of food is. So we need to come to some agreement on what a unit of food is. But that also means we have to have very ambitious targets for cutting those emissions per unit of food. And that's why, I mean, it may be, you know, like an 80% decrease or 75% decrease. So that's big. Now, the other thing I would say about our livestock, with the kind of livestock now, and dairy and chicken is a lot fewer emissions than beef. You start with the Minnesota beef farm, the role of beef, but the fish can produce beef, but obviously our growth there is more than the lower emissions. Last thing I'll say is, again, don't trust all the numbers. So one slide I missed, I passed over, was actually a summary of the presentation by a researcher at Wageningen University, who's the FAO, who's been doing life cycle analysis of livestock. The FAO is coming out with some new analyses. And there are all kinds of numbers that just have to be assumed. What is the current replacement ratios in the development in many, most of the world? What is the forage quality? No, no. They just make up their numbers that they have to and give us some idea. Now, we, one of the research challenges is we need to know those numbers. You cannot come up with intelligent policy for improving, reducing emissions while improving food production in a country with a lot of rainfall unless we have a much better idea what the livestock system numbers are, the replacement ratios, the forage qualities.
This is the whole stops of the value in Israel. Yeah, you're right. I think the comment and the question, I mean, the comment is, I think, somewhat sobering from your talk. The number of dead ends that seem to be around mitigation protection, whether it's sort of carbon or about the use of animal. And I think what that suggests to me is that it's unfortunate that the IPCC seems to have so little solid research to go on with other people, so it's going to be really important that for their first assessment report coming out around 2015 or so, that there's a lot more of this research to rely on and have much more reliable results. And hopefully the global research might contribute to that. The question I had though was regarding economics. You put up a graph on price to the consumer of food. But I wonder if you've looked at all that the effects of price being received by farmers for their products, and where you see where you've done modeling on that, where you see that making a contribution. The obvious thing that occurs to one is that if you're not getting the price of your product, you're not going to afford the technology to build it.
Well, the graph I have is that the crop price is not final food prices, so that roughly equivalent to the price of farmers in the U.S. This is one of the challenges. Farming is a challenging and difficult enterprise, and anyone who deals with farmers has to have sympathy for the fact that prices periodically collapse and make life even harder for a farmer. On the other hand, low crop prices have been one of the ways, has been the main way in which we have prevented hunger from being worse, because we have so many poor people. And it would be delightful if we could have those fewer poor people and higher crop prices to still solve hunger. But right now we still have this large number of extremely poor people. In the technology front for farming, I think this is our challenge. We know that to be sustainable over the long term, things have to ultimately basically pay for themselves. But I do think that there is a role of government in spurring these innovations and in helping the investments in that area. And whether there are forms of reward and payment that can be provided to farmers to encourage lower carbon production, something worth looking at. But for those who haven't been big admirers of our farm subsidy system, have admired New Zealand's approach to the problem. It's something for the long run that I would be a sort of caution.
So I was interested in the dilemma around public policy, around which comes first, your regulatory or economic interest, right, or your technological business. New Zealand's introducing emissions trading scheme on the competitive proposing to introduce agriculture to it with a fair amount of confirmation that agriculture included in 2015, and many saying that governments should not move to apply regulation or economic constraint until such time as the technologies exist, where others would argue that the technologies will not be developed until such time as the sectors recognise that there is a cost to them and that they need to get ahead of the play. I'd be interested in your perspective on that debate, which comes first, the science or the public policy regulation.
Well, I think both of them have a role in moving forward simultaneously in the right amount of dimension. I think most governments, and I'm not an expert on the New Zealand situation, but most governments, they want to do a cost assessment of what are the technological opportunities and costs of achieving certain reductions. And we know that there's low-hanging fruit and high-hanging fruit in the agricultural sector. I don't know, frankly, nothing about the New Zealand situation. But I think that basically having a combination of both and phasing them, a lot of research and some phasing in of the whatever incentive or regulation, not a lot of countries are likely to move forward the way New Zealand is regulating in agriculture, precisely because they're a pure protocol country with a large source of agricultural emissions. But I basically am in favor of a lot of technology research and a little of the opposite, a little of the push and send it for emissions.
Thank you. And we have time for one more question and now we can.
Thank you very much. My name is Maggie Gill. I was very interested in your analysis of the importance of land and also the end point to needing to look for rent alongside food production. But I think if we go down that route, then we need to take into account what to put into it. And when you're talking about livestock, talking about the carbon per unit of food. And to me, particularly with livestock, one of the benefits of grain is that they can use land that doesn't produce any other sort of food. And to me, there has to be something that I hope might come out of this meeting about getting multiple indicators that don't just take this down the carbon, but also take into that land which and is so important. I just wonder if you thought through any of that sort of multiple.
Well, I think I am obviously, even though I think we have in general higher emissions from food production on rangeland on a worldwide basis, we need rangeland. I come out of a biodiversity tradition. One reason rangeland has less food production is because we actually appropriate less of the carbon uptake, which means we leave more for other living creatures, so there are other benefits as well. But purely from a selfish perspective, we need to, as what you say, utilize the natural grazing. I don't think that's actually a policy issue for us now, because the issue is not whether or not we're going to reduce our grazing land or our natural grazing lands. It's going to be whether we continue to expand our grazing land in the forest. Almost all new grazing land comes from tropical forest expansion. So the first goal would be to just stop that. If we ever got beyond that, the place to focus on reforestation is in the tropical tropical forest grazing lands. So probably as a whole, the least well-utilized major land category on the planet are human-created grazing lands out of tropical forests. So these are not native grazing lands, but actual native forests, where their productivity and biodiversity benefits used for grazing are modest by comparison to what they could be.
Thank you.
diligence on your behalf can I extend our thanks to Tim for what I think has been an exceptionally thought-provoking start to our conference. I thank you, Tim, for your contribution, and I don't know how many people will enjoy it.